Welcome to the Dr. D. Martini Show, where international author, speaker, teacher, and philosopher, Dr. John D. Martini shares with you exactly how to break through whatever is holding you back from your best life.
Welcome to the Dr. D. Martini Show. This is episode number 5, where today John will be sharing with you the 9 must-do action steps to achieve wealth and financial freedom. So if you've ever asked yourself or wondered why some people are able to achieve financial independence and freedom and why others aren't, inside of this episode, John is going to be sharing his 9 action steps that he's identified through 45 plus years of traveling and teaching and researching in that exact domain. So if you're tired of beating yourself up over your current financial situation or any previous decisions that you perceive to be the wrong ones, this is the exact episode for you.
For those of you who are brand new to Dr. DeMartini's material, he is a human behavioral specialist with studies in over 290 different disciplines, or ologies as John calls them. And over the course of a 45 plus year career, John has gone from 17 and nearly dying in the back of a tent with strychnine poisoning to becoming a master of his life and then allowing others to see that same beauty in the world. If you would like to take the very first action from this podcast, John recommends to head over to drdmartini.com, where not only will you find all of John's materials in one central location, but you will be able to do the values determination process, which is a central pillar of all of John's teaching. So enjoy the episode, and we look forward to speaking to you very soon.
So action number 1, Dr. DeMartini, you say that to clarify purpose and to create a big enough why to match a wealthy desire, you also refer to knowing the reason for wealth as having a burning desire to serve humanity and building your legacy. Can you unpack this further and elaborate what needs to be understood and then what needs to be done to put this into action?
Well, the main objective or the of that principle, I'll give you an analogy or a story here. If you were behind, let's say you had a family and you were behind on your bills and struggling a bit, and you went to somebody and said, I would really like to borrow some money because I need to pay my bills and pay for, you know, groceries and rent and everything else. If you went to somebody and asked them, can you help me? They'd probably say, thank you, but no, thank you. I've got my own challenges and my own bills. You'd probably say no. They'd say no. If you went to them and said, I'm current with all my bills, but I didn't get quite enough savings to help my kids go to college. Is there a way you could assist me in helping my kids go to college? Can I borrow some money to help on that? They'd probably say, thank you, but no, thank you. I've got my own children that I've got to pay for college. But if all of a sudden you went to them and you said, recently, one of my children was killed in a car crash, and it's because she had to cross the road. My daughter had to cross the road across a busy intersection to go to the playground. And so since she's passed on now, we've just decided that we want to build a park in the remaining lot that's in our neighborhood and buy the lot and build a playground there so the kids on this side of the highway don't have to cross the highway and take a risk. And if there'd be any way you'd like to pitch in and participate in contributing to help us, in case you have children, help us build a beautiful park here so kids basically can be safer on this side of the road. Now the person would probably say, oh, because now the cause is bigger than yourself. It's bigger than your own individual family or your children. It's now going into a collective that encompasses the whole community, or at least that side of the road. So the larger the goal, the larger the commitment, the more you and other people will most likely participate in the contribution or expenses of that project. Now, the reason I mention this is the greater the cause, the greater the potential for wealth that you'll extract from yourself. I had a lady many years ago that was a very successful broker in the financial industry. And she was a patient of mine, and she'd come into my office, and she was making very good money. I mean, quite a bit of money in a day at that time. In the process of doing that, she was plateaued, though, and she wanted to make more income. And the only way she could earn more income is to have a greater cause, I felt. So I asked her, if all of a sudden you were to die right now and you had 24 hours to live, what's not done? What's not complete? Or if this was your last year, what was not complete in your life? And she just paused for a second. She thought, well, the thing that I feel like I haven't done is I haven't assisted my mother. She sacrificed and worked two jobs to help us go through school. And I'd like to help my mom do something she's always wanted to do. And anyway, after discussing it, we came up with the realization that she'd like to build a theater, a major theater, and raise money to build a theater in the city of Houston. And her clients and her, she initiated a cause to build this massive theater. I mean, it was a very expensive theater, nearly $100 million. And because she was inspired by the idea that I want to do that for her mom, she got involved in it. It took a 6-year project to get it built. But in the 6 years, her mom was still alive. She made sure that the opening of this theater, her mom was there. Because of that, she literally went from $18,000 a day in the financial industry to $45,000 a day on average income, because she had a cause bigger than herself. So having some cause, having some reason, having a big enough why for building wealth for yourself and the people you care about, your community, your family, your community, your city, your state, your nation, your world, the bigger the cause, the higher the probability that you will do what it takes to save, invest, and accumulate the money for that cause. Now, financial independence is nice. That's one. But that's just the beginning, because that's obtainable, but you may have a bigger cause needed to get you in gear to do something extraordinary. You may want to go all the way to Mars like Elon Musk, or you may want to build a new city like Mahasinathambi, but you need a cause to really build vast fortunes. And so that's the point in the principle. Have some cause bigger than yourself to get beyond yourself.
Thank you, Dr. And action number two, you said that the most important thing was to adjust the hierarchy of values to match the level of wealth a person desires. You indicated that creating a bigger void and the six steps exercise is part of this. Can you take this a little bit further?
Yes. I've stated before, and I'm going to restate it, that the hierarchy of your values dictates your financial destiny. Tell me what you value, and I'll tell you where you're headed with your money. I actually consulted with a gentleman who made $6 million+ in 1 year. But at the end of the year, he had to borrow $327,000 to pay his taxes. And so it didn't matter how much he made. What mattered is how he managed what he made. And the hierarchy of your values determine how you manage it. And he had an assistant working for him that made only $24,000 a year. This is about 20 years ago. And what's interesting is she was saving 20% of it, and she was closer to financial independence. Somehow we're having some noise in the background. Not sure what it is. But the one that was saving making $24,000 was saving 20%. And so that person was actually going to be closer to financial independence. So it doesn't matter how much money you make. It has to do with how you manage what you make, and the hierarchy of your values dictates how you manage it. Tell me what you value most, second most, third most, et cetera, down your hierarchy. And I'll tell you, when money comes to it, how you'll spend it. So if your highest value is your children, your money will go to your children. If your highest value is clothes and looks and appearance, then it'll go to that. If your highest value is your religion and spirituality of some form, then you'll donate to the church or the synagogue or the temple or the mosque. If your highest value is fitness, you'll go and do that. If your highest value is adventure, you'll spend your money on that. Whatever you value most is where your money goes. So if you don't have a value on wealth building, a true value on accumulating, where you're wanting to buy things that go up in value, assets, instead of immediate gratifying consumables that depreciate, you're not likely to get financially independent. So I observed thousands of people as I'm traveling the world, how many people are basically, you know, saying they want to be financially independent. When you ask them, how many want to be financially independent? Everybody puts their hand up, but only less than 1% obtain it. And I found out that the people who obtained it had a higher value on wealth building, and they would rather, you know, go for, instead of immediate gratification of spending with impulse buying, they'd rather save their money and put it into assets that accumulated and that went up in value. They appreciated. If you don't have a value in wealth building, you won't put your money into something that goes up in value. You keep buying things that are immediately gratifying, they go down in value, and you're working against yourself. So you have to have a value on wealth building. And I found six things common to people who had a value on wealth building. And I call them the six steps to wealth because of it. And I'd like to go through those, because a person who has these six steps in their value structure, their hierarchy of values, have a higher probability of reaching financial independence. So the first one is, it's unrealistic to think you're going to be financially independent if you aren't serving people. You know, if you're not working and you're not serving people, unless you inherit money, or unless you somehow are married to somebody that's making money, which is still building a business, you're not likely to have a source of income to be able to save and invest and accumulate. So the first step in wealth building is to actually, to increase the probability of wealth building and to have a higher value of wealth building, is to write down 200 benefits. And I mean 200, not 20, but 200 benefits of building a business that serves ever greater numbers of people. Because if you have a work ethic, you won't find a billionaire. Richard Branson built a series of businesses, 300, 400 businesses that serve vast numbers of people. Bill Gates, massive business. Elon Musk, massive business. Buffett, massive business. All the billionaires and all the decamillionaires and up all have businesses that serve vast numbers of people. So if you don't have a real value on that, I'd write down 200 benefits of actually desiring to serve people. Because if you're poor, it's because you're not caring about humanity enough to serve and make a source of income and making fair exchange and having equity with people and making sure that you charge for services, that you serve people. So 200 benefits of building a business to serve vast numbers of people, great number, ever greater numbers of people. And that means you have to care about humanity to find out what the great needs in humanity are and go out of your way to fill those needs. And that you got to find the problems that the world is facing and find out a solution for it and to do it more effectively and efficient than somebody else and do something that means something to you, that you're inspired, that you can't wait to get up in the morning and go and tackle. So you get creative in finding those solutions, or find somebody that's already made the solutions and then broker that and communicate it. But there's got to be a service there. And if you don't have a caring desire to serve people, it's kind of unrealistic to expect wealth. So 200 benefits. Now, these are not 200 benefits of spending money as if you built the business and now you have money. Don't write 200 benefits. Oh, I can buy that yacht. I can travel. I can get that fancy car. I can do that. That's the benefits of consuming and buying things that depreciate value. I want the benefits to be learning the art of leadership, learning how to manage people, learning how to listen to customers, learning how to organize people, learning how to efficiently orchestrate priorities, things that actually it takes to build a business. The second of the six steps is 200 benefits of managing that business more effectively and efficiently where it's maximizing profits. Because I know companies that have huge business incomes, but very little margins. I also know some that have much smaller incomes, but greater margins. They make the same net return. So you want to make sure that you're putting 200 benefits of actually managing the business where it's making profits. That means working on the business, not in it. The first one, the first step of building a business serves the customer. The second one is also serving you and the employees to serve the customer. It's making everybody work more effectively and efficiently and making more profit margins for yourself and for the employees and to more efficiently serve clients so you can compete in the marketplace. The third one is 200 benefits of saving an ever progressive portion of the profits. Because if you're not saving a portion and building up a liquid cushion, you're not going to stabilize your business. You're going to always live on the edge. It's going to be anxious all the time. You're going to burn out on it. And you don't take advantage of opportunities when there's dips in markets and when you have opportunities to buy great opportunities to grow the business. So, you know, it's interesting that right now, Buffett has $109 billion in cash in his reserves. Apple has $290 billion in cash in reserves. The biggest companies and the biggest and wealthiest people have cash reserves. They don't let the outer world volatilely alter their strategy. And they make sure that they have enough cushion to make it where the outer world doesn't mean anything. You want at least 3 months, maybe 6 months, and some people have it all the way to a year's worth of liquid capital reserved. The average 100 top companies have at least 4 to 6 months worth of liquid capital. And I know the Bill Gates and them keep at least a year's worth of liquid capital in Microsoft. That's $150, $60 billion sitting in liquid capital. So you want to save and you want to have a forced accelerated savings where you're increasing your savings every quarter. The second you get comfortable on your savings, increase it. And it's not how much you save, it's the habit of saving. So you want to make sure that you save whatever you feel you can afford. And I've never met anybody that can't save something. You may think, well, I can't afford it. I can't afford it. I got bills right now. Well, you can just save $1 a month. Well, yeah, well, start. It's not how much, it's the starting, it's the habit development. You may make it to 2 and then 4 and then 8 and then 16. It might grow, but you got to start somewhere. I know some people have started hundreds, some at thousands, some at tens of thousands. But whatever it is, you want to start and make a habit of it and do it electronically so it's not emotional, because emotions destroy wealth, and strategies, electronic strategies, help you build it. And just automatically take it from your business, primary business account, right into a savings account. I call it the immortal savings, and never touch it. Even though it's a reserve, you don't touch it unless there's truly an emergency. It's gone. It's into savings. It's now working for you. And if you don't have it saved and invested, you'll be working your whole life for money and not have it work for you. So you need to write 200 benefits of saving an ever-progressive portion and increasing it. Out of all the things I've done in wealth building, that was the most significant thing that grew my wealth, was actually saving an ever-progressive portion of it and growing it and accelerating it. The second you get comfortable in whatever you're saving, push it just a little further. I always say raise it 10% every quarter and watch what happens. You'll double your savings every 2 years, and that will just compound amazingly over time. The fourth of the six steps is 200 benefits of investing in ever greater degrees of leverage, learning how to actually stair-step the classes of investments and move up the ladder so you're actually increasing your yield and getting greater degrees of leverage, a little bit more risk and reward ratios, but higher yields, and learn how to build brands to leverage, and learn how to do secondary incomes, and learn how to basically use sometimes other people's money to help you grow your business. So you want to leverage, and that's basic on networking. There's many ways of leveraging, but if you want to master the art of leveraging, and so 200 benefits of increasing the investments into higher class, higher yields, higher risk reward ratios, and higher leveraging. The next one is 200 benefits of accumulating a vast fortune. If you don't have a reason for doing it, you won't. And financial independence is just the beginning. When you reach financial independence, you go, okay, now what? I've done that. Now what? What am I going to do for my kids? What am I going to do for my family? What am I going to do for my community? What am I going to do for the world? You want to go and think about a bigger game. And 200 benefits of that, because if you do, you'll do it. If not, the second you get to financial independence, you'll buy clutter and you'll have stuff run you. And your vanity will basically overrule you. So the last step, the sixth step, is 200 benefits of creating a financial cause that leaves a legacy. This goes back to the first thing I mentioned about having a cause. The greater the cause, the greater the potential for wealth. You'll drive yourself to do something if you have a bigger cause. You know, it's amazing what you can do if you have something that is so important to you that you're not going to let anything stop you, not even your own fears. And you put yourself on the line with a collective group of people to push yourself to find out what you're capable of doing. So again, building a business that serves greater, ever greater numbers of people, making sure that you manage the business where it's more effective and efficient, maximizing profits, make sure you're saving an ever progressive portion of the profits. The next one is investing in ever greater degrees of leverage. Next one is accumulating vast fortune, accumulating a growing fortune, and then creating a financial cause to keep it growing so you have something perpetuity. 200 benefits of each of these will raise wherever financial wealth building is on your values and increase the probability of you seeing opportunities, making decisions that are in your favor financially, and also taking the action. Because you can have control of your perceptions, decisions, and actions. If you have a high value on something, you alert and have the highest awareness, perceptions, and decision-making process. You're quicker and more efficient in those areas if you have a value on it. So I don't find people that have a value on everything but money getting ahead financially. Because you keep spending money on those other things. Everybody has their wealth in the form of what they value most. If they don't have a value on financial wealth, it'll be in the other forms and never be back into the financial form. And the financial form is one of the most universal. It has the most applications. So it's to your advantage to actually do the six steps to wealth. But 200, and you may stop and get plateaued and go blank. Put it on a computer and then come back to it and keep working on it. The people who have taken the time to keep doing it and not write, do not write as benefits and 200 benefits as of things about spending money. If you're writing the benefits of spending money instead of actually saving and investing and accumulating it, you're going to be basically working yourself against your financial independence. You don't want to raise your lifestyle unless you raise your savings and your taxes equal amounts to keep yourself in check. That way you make sure you incrementally, consistently get to raise your lifestyle through time instead of living beyond your means. Most of the people out there in the world today, you see these big fancy houses and cars and things of this nature, and you think, oh my God, they're financially wealthy. A lot of them are broke. They're barely making it. And in fact, when downturns occur, they have to sell their homes and their cars sometimes. So even brokers in the financial industry are stuck in this. It's not sometimes what it looks like. You want to make sure that you're really building wealth that's solid, not just appearance, because otherwise your lifestyle will rule you and not your wealth, building your wealth to do something great. Because when you're doing something you love to do, that's what wealth building does. People say, why would you want to build wealth? And so it'd be just to accumulate money? So no, because what it does is it gives you the freedom to do what you love and love what you do and not have to go to work, but you go to work because you love to. Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, these guys still work because they love to. Oprah, they do it not because they need the money. They do it because they're inspired to go make a difference. So those are the six steps to wealth. And I am certain that they can help you increase the probability of you perceiving, deciding, and acting in a way that brings wealth.
Thank you, John. That's a really powerful six-step exercise. My favorite concept that you speak about is increasing your deserve level to increase your wealth. You mentioned part of this is clearing out shame and guilt. Can you explain a little bit more detail the idea of increasing your deserve level and why that's important for wealth building, and then elaborate a little bit on the actions you would recommend someone take?
Yeah, what happens is, let's say you're in a financial transaction. You've just sold a product and somebody's paid you for it. If they pay you less than what you both agreed to, you tend to get a little angry at it. You tend to be narcissistic and you say, hey, buddy, you owe me the money. You owe me the difference. And so you get narcissistic when you feel you've done a service or provided a product and they didn't pay you what you agreed it would be worth. On the other end, if you are in a situation where you did a service, they paid for it, but you don't feel that your product or your service delivered quite as much as what they paid. As a result of it, you'll have a built-in thermostat to say, you know what, I think I better give them a little extra to make sure they get a fair exchange. So you'll tend to be more altruistic when you feel that you haven't given your side of the bargain, and you'll get narcissistic when you feel that they haven't given their side of the bargain. So anytime you've done something less than what you provide, or you think you've caused more pain and pleasure to somebody, you get altruistic and sacrifice, and you feel kind of ashamed. And anytime you do something you feel you've done more than that, you get narcissistic and feel kind of proud. Pride tends to make you narcissistic, and shame tends to make you altruistic. Well, when you're altruistic, if you go into a business transaction, you'll tend to negotiate away your profits on the negotiation table. If you're narcissistic, you'll try to get as much as you can from them and be unfair. Both narcissism and altruism ultimately underlie some of the things that undermine wealth building. It's when you're authentic with yourself and you're in a state of equanimity, you're not exaggerating or minimizing yourself, not pride or shame, and you're in a state of equity with them, you're not minimizing them with resentment or putting them up on a pedestal with infatuation, but you've leveled the playing field that you have the highest probability of sustainable long-term transactions with people called fair exchange. And there's inequity. That's why they call it shares and equities in the financial industry. You're sharing in an equal manner. You want a relationship when you're married that somebody is a match that you respect. You want to be in business with people you respect and have a balance to. And when you have wealth and a cushion of capital, you're more likely to select the clients that are more in line and you respect instead of being desperate and taking anybody. So shame and guilt undermine wealth building because it makes you tend to feel that you owe people things. And so anybody that comes along is an opportunist. And anybody there that feels that they want an open hand, a charitable thing, they can come to you and you'll be willing to give out and you won't value yourself. So here's the exercise I would encourage people to do, is to make a list of everything that they've ever think they've done that hasn't lived up to expectation relative to themselves or other people. Something they feel guilt about, shame about, or feel like they don't want people to know about. Anything they want to hide, they don't want anybody to see or know about. Make a list of them and find out how whatever you did served you and others, the people specifically that you thought were shortchanged or hurt by it. And go and find out the other side, because in the Breakthrough Experience, the program I do, that's my signature program, I help people break their shame and guilt. Every weekend we do this. If they've been storing from decades in some cases, and the second they clear it, they open up the gateway now to receive. They don't even realize that the burden of shame and guilt in their life from all the things they think that they haven't lived up to, or they've some harmed somebody, is actually keeping them from feeling worthy enough to receive and hold on to money. So we go in there, we go in and show them how to clear the shame and guilt. And it's eye-opening to see that. The number one thing that Foster Hibbert, who worked with Napoleon Hill, that I used to lecture with, that we said that the number one thing that stopped me from building wealth and feeling worthy of financial freedom is shame and guilt. So by going and making a list of everything you've ever done that you think you've made a mistake on or hurt somebody or shamed on, and go find out, serve people. Because the truth is, no matter what you've done or not done, you're worthy of love. And no matter what you've done, there's two sides to it. There may be a downside, but there's also an upside, and people learn from it. And finding out how that serves people and serves you, and clearing out all the shame and all the burden that you're carrying around, will liberate you to feel, you know what, I deserve now. Your deserved level goes up when you clear out your shame and guilt. But if you go into pride, that's not to your advantage either. You don't want to go to pride or shame. You want to have self-governance where you're not proud or shamed. Because pride makes you go out in the world and makes you project your assumptions onto the world as an entrepreneur. And you think, well, I know what's best for the customer. I know what's best for everybody. You become autocratic and you're not listening to the people. So both pride or shame can undermine wealth building. It doesn't lead to fair exchange. So in the breakthrough experience, I go through there and I show you in the DeMartini method how to dissolve pride and shame so you have mastery of self-governance and you have more fair exchange between you and other people. And you're now centered, authentic. And people trust people that are authentic. They don't trust people on the other side of the personas and masks that we wear. So let's clear out the pride and shame. Let's get present and let's have fair exchange. And that's one of the keys of building a business that serves vast numbers of people.
Thank you, Dr. DeMartini. You've also said that there are 9 things that were essential to have in place in order to determine if a person is serious about creating financial independence. Can you explain and then outline these 9 things?
Oh, I like this. This is when I was 28 years old, I got smacked, you might say, in the face with these 9 actions. And it was a decision. It was a major decision point in my life. If I hadn't had this hit me by a gentleman named Jim McKinley, I don't know if I would have been where I am financially today. So just listen really carefully, because when people say, I want to be financially independent and put their hands up, I can tell if they're on their way to being financially independent if they can answer yes to all 9 of these questions. If they can't say yes to all these 9 questions, they really don't have a value in wealth building yet. That doesn't mean they can't. It doesn't mean they can't go and do the exercise I just said, clearing out the shame and stacking up the benefits. But let's go through those 9 because they're eye-opening. And it'll make some of you have a knot in your stomach, possibly. And some of you go, oh, my God, I give up. You have to face reality. Financial independence isn't because of praying and hoping and thinking prosperous and fantasizing and stuff. It's really a grounding process of basically serving people. So when I finally got past the fantasies and got grounded and got how it really works, my wealth grew. So here we go. So you might want to write these down and take notes on these, because it's gonna be probably as chilling as it was for me when I got it at age 28. But my life changed at 28. My financial journey began that time. Before that, I could save some money for things, a car, travels, books, and things like that. But I didn't actually save and invest money for financial independence until 28. And my life changed there. So here they go. Number 1, if you don't know what your total assets are, you need to make a list of the total assets. Every financial asset you have that's a legitimate conservative number. Don't exaggerate it. You know, you can have a house, you may think it's a greater house than it is, but the real dollar value, what it's worth in equity or what it's really worth at the sales price after all the cost, that's the true value. When you look at the stocks, it's not the high when it's above the mean, it's the mean and the average. Same thing for other forms of investment. You need to look at what your total assets are, because if you don't even know what you have now, you have no foundation to know where you're starting from. The second one of the 9 is, what are your total liabilities? Because in all probability, some of you will have some debts out there still. I don't have debt right now. I've been debt-free for many years. But in my earlier phase of my life, that's not uncommon. You have mortgages, cars, payments, school loans, you know, who knows what. But you want to go and look at what all your debts are. That's debts to other people in any form, or banks or mortgages or any company. Once you look at your assets, total them, make sure you're clear, be conservative, make sure they're solid. Once you know your total liabilities, you now can determine number 3, and that's your net worth. And that may be positive. It may be negative. In my 20s, it was definitely negative. In my 30s, it was definitely negative initially in the early 30s and late 20s. But then it became positive mid-30s, and it grew from there. But at first, you have to face the truth of where you are. You can't live in la-la land. And you need to find out what your net worth is and get clear and total them. And it's actually eye-opening, and it grounds you. You know, money circulates through the economy from those who value it least to those who value it most, and those who have the least order around it and those, to those who have the most order. So whoever the most organized and more structured and objective about their money are the people that are going to end up having it. It's not going to circulate to people that don't know what to do with it. Why would somebody give somebody money that doesn't even know what to do with it? So you're going to need to get the assets, the liabilities, and then the net worth. The fourth one is, what exactly is the annual passive investment income that you would love to live on per year? This is before taxes. How much do you want to live on? Do you want to live on $50,000 a year, $100,000 a year, $250,000 a year, $500,000 a year, $1 million a year, $10 million a year? What is it that you truly would pursue and want to live on? So you want to make sure you find out what that is so you have a goal. And what this does, it makes you, the next steps are going to make you real about this goal. Are you really serious about it or not? So let's just say we're going to pick $100,000 a year, US dollars, translate that whatever currency you're in. But let's say it's $100,000. You'd like to make at least $8,000 a month, about $8,200 a month to make $100,000 a year to live on. I'm just going to pick a number because ones and zeros are easy to use. So that's number four. How much do you want to live on the money annually, passively, from your investments? Not from working, but from investments. The next one, the fifth one, is, what average interest rate do you believe you can earn with your knowledge in the investment world? From money markets, to bonds, to T-bills, to stocks, to different types of stocks, different classes of stocks, to real estate, to commodities, to art, whatever investments you intend to give to start accumulating, what is the average conservative yield, interest rate yield, do you believe you can get? Now, you may say something, you may want to fantasize about a high number because you may have specialized knowledge, but that's an active trading process that might give you those numbers. But I'm talking about a passive investment vehicle or a series of varieties of them. What's the net? And you need to figure that number out. And I'm just going to pick 6% because I believe that pretty well with money in an index fund, most large cap index funds around the world, you could probably get that, an index fund. But let's just say 6%. The next one is, now you got to determine what exactly is the average inflation rate in your country. And so on average, 100-year inflation rate, not a short term, because in the last 15 to 20 years, or maybe 20 years, we've had a very small inflation rate. But at one time in the 80s, it was way up in double digits. So right now, we're sitting at a low interest inflation rate. But average for 100 years in America is 5%. I use 5% calculations, even though it's higher than what is actually currently, because it's probably heading back up again. Now that the stock market's going climbing right now, inflation's headed up again. So in the process of doing that, and they're printing more money to disperse it, so in the process of doing that, you want to know what that inflation rate is, because that erodes the actual interest rate you can earn on your investments. The next one is, what exactly is the gross total investment net worth you have that you need in order to give you at that interest rate and then inflation rate the amount you want per year? So let's say you want $100,000 per year. You can earn 6% average on all your investments. You have a 5% inflation rate. Well, let's just take that. 6% into 100% is 16.66. You take 16.66 and multiply it times the $100,000 a year that you want. You need $1.66666 million in investments earning 6% a year today, right now, to be able to live on $100,000. But you have to factor inflation in. So if inflation is 5%, so you take 1.66666, multiply it times 5%, that gives you about $53,000 or $4,000, add it to the amount of 1.66666, it comes out about 1.73, let's be on the high side of it, $1.73 million If you have $1.73 million earning 6%, factoring in the inflation rate, right now, if you had it today in your investments, you could live on a $100,000 lifestyle the rest of your life and never worry about it again. You're taken care of financially. Unless you want to raise the lifestyle, then those numbers would have to go up. But if you lived on a moderate lifestyle of $100,000 a year, you could do that. All you need is 1.73 right now. But now you're thinking, oh, now that I know that amount, I realize, I got a problem. I only have $50,000 or let's say $50,000 net worth right now, and I need 1.73. So that means I need $1.725 million between now and some point.
Listen up. Imagine knowing with absolute certainty that your life is working for you, that you're on track and that you're making progress towards the goals and dreams that you desire every day. If you've been an avid listener to this podcast, you'll have heard Dr. DeMartini mention his signature program, The Breakthrough Experience. It's a two-day weekend seminar where he shows you how to take everything that you've been learning on this podcast and put it into practice so that you can gain the shifts that you most desire for your life. If you would love to transform your life, and if you've been a little bit uncertain where to start or how to get there, then join Dr. John DeMartini at The Breakthrough Experience so he can show you how. What you'll learn in these 2 days is truly life-transforming. It's time to put the power in your hands to create your magnificent life. To find out more, go to demartini.fm/seminar. You can also access the link in the show notes below. We look forward to seeing you there. And now, let's continue with this episode.
Today, to be able to have financial independence. So there's a shortfall. The next step is, what is the shortfall? That's number eight. What exactly is the shortfall you have between your net worth and the amount of net worth you need, your current net worth and the net worth you need in order to have financial independence? And then when you do that, now you stop and you go, oh, I'm really short on this. So now you think, well, I got to gradually earn this over time and I got to save and invest it. So now you got to factor in inflation in there to find out how long do I do it. So you say a goal, say, okay, 5% inflation means the cost of living is going to double in 15 years. So that means I'm going to work on financial independence over the next 15 years. My 1.73 million is now going to require $3.3 million later, 15 years from now, with a doubling of the inflation. I'm going to need $3.3 million in 15 years saved and invested, earning 6% to be able to live the lifestyle I want, because my cost of living is going to be $200,000 by then. Now I think, okay, I need $3.3 million. I've got $50,000. I need 3.3. I need to be saving 20-something thousand dollars a month. Whoa, on average. So now the next step, number nine, is what's your strategy? Now, usually about that time when you look at that number, you either go, give it up, or I can't do that, or maybe I need to lower the amount I want to have on financial independence. Now you understand why less than 1% ever make it to financial independence. They don't realize that it takes saving a good percentage of their money to be able to get ahead, to make this happen. But they said, I remember reading about it many years ago, that if you're 20 years old, you need to be saving 10% of your gross income at that current lifestyle. If you're 30 years old, 20%. If you're 40 years old, 30%. If you're 50 years old, 40%. If you're 60 years old, 50% of your gross income to be able to have that type of money accumulated, to have that financial independence. And the average person saves 1% to 3%. So they never get there. That's why 99% of the people don't have financial independence. So when I got that number at age 28 and I looked at that, I went, oh, I'm not able to save that. At the time, I was only saving $200 a month. And I thought, I either got to get into gear or give up on my, I realize it's a fantasy if I'm not willing to go out and serve more people, build my business, those six steps. So then I sat there and I go, okay, there's no way I can start saving $20,000 a month. I'm not making that. So I had to do what is called a force accelerated savings technique. I decided I was going to start at $200 a month and I was going to accelerate my savings and I was going to make it every 3 months increase by 10%. Well, I went from 200 to 300 to 500 to 750 to $1,000 a month. And I was able to incrementally grow it and focus on growing my business. And then I started at 10%. I went to 1,100 for the next 3 months, 1,210 for the next 3 months, 1,343 the next 3 months. I kept making it 1,464 the next 3 months, I kept increasing it by a Pascal triangle, 10% increase every quarter. And at first I was below that amount that I needed per month. But after a while I went above it because I'd start doubling and doubling and doubling the amount of savings. And I grew my business and I grew my brand. And all of a sudden I was saving more than I needed to get that outcome. And I ran a projection every quarter to see where I was now with my net worth. What is the shortfall? What is the goal with inflation? How much I'm saving? And I kept running it and paying attention to it. And that way I could see that my financial independence, which took originally 34 years in my vision, then it went down to 32 and went down to 30, went to 28, and eventually went down under 10 and eventually 5, and eventually I made it. And then I started exceeding it. And I kept increasing the savings. And I followed a strategy, a force accelerated savings technique. And if I don't have those nine things in my mind, what is my total assets? What is my total liabilities? What is my net worth? How much do I want to live on passively, annually? What exactly is the interest rate I can earn? What exactly is inflation rate? How much total net worth do I need earning that interest rate against inflation to give me that amount? What is the shortfall? And what is my strategy? Those are the nine absolutely essential steps that if you don't have those in your mind, you're basically telling the world, I have no intention of being financially independent. Because it's going to take those things, not a wisp, not a fantasy, not a hope, not a prayer. It's going to take you grounding and serving ever greater numbers of people and learning how to build wealth methodically. So those are the nine steps.
Thank you, John. Another essential must-do action that you've mentioned is the law of sustainable fair exchange. Can you explain that a little bit further?
Yeah, I did briefly mention it, but if we do not do fair exchange, nobody's going to continue doing business with us. If we feel that we gave more than what they gave us in a transaction, we tend to not want to do business with them. If we feel that they gave us more than we do, we kind of feel guilty. And they don't want to do business with us anymore. It's only fair exchange, sustainable fair exchange that lasts, cause lasting relationships. I mean, in your relationship with the loved ones, if they don't feel that they're getting a fair exchange, they're going to go somewhere else. People want to be loved and appreciated for who they are. And people in business want to have fair exchange. And that's what builds trust. Trust is a byproduct of fair exchange. It's not about what you say. It's about having a fair exchange. And I've been in situations, I think most everybody out there is listening right now and viewing, have had moments where they've been in a transaction with somebody and somebody didn't pay. And they felt kind of resentful to it. And they felt, you know, narcissistic and felt that they deserved and their deserve level goes up. And they've also been on the transaction where they did a service and they didn't feel like they delivered quite what they hoped in that service. And they went out of their way to make sure the person was satisfied. You have a built-in thermostat for a fair exchange. It's intuitive and it's trying to keep you in fair exchange to maximize your potential economically. And so that's the key. Sustainable fair exchange is the only thing that's working. You know, even Bill Gates and Warren Buffett talk about it in their book, Creative Capitalism. Bill Gates, when he first started many years ago in the 90s or whatever, he built a very big business and he accumulated a vast fortune up to $81 billion at the time. But he was somewhat became a monopoly. Every computer had to have his software in it. And so after a while, it wasn't fair to the little guys and the other computer companies. And there was a monopoly. And the government stepped in and they created an antitrust and anti-monopoly systems. And all over the world, there were attacks on Microsoft and Bill Gates. And then as a result of it, he had to bring that back down and he went to started the Bill Gates Foundation for philanthropy. Now he's got a balance between give and receive. As a result of it, in his Creative Capitalism with Buffett, he outlines how important this was as his lesson. And so it's important to make sure you don't go overly narcissistic with pride or overly altruistic with shame, but to make sure you love yourself. Believe it or not, love is the key to financial transaction. I've heard over the centuries by ignorant people that somehow spirituality and materiality don't match. But the truth is true spirituality, which is equanimity, and true materiality, which is equity, are the same thing. And so if you really, really, I said at a church one time, if you're poor, it's because you're not caring about humanity and not going out of your way to serve people and maintaining fair exchanges with people. Go out and care about people, fill their needs, find a way of serving them, do something that inspires you, and have a transaction that's fair and you'll grow wealth. That's the first foundation starting point for growing wealth. So yes, fair exchange is the only thing that lasts. And people that are autocratic and try to dominate, and think they can get away with it, eventually it backfires on them. It's just a matter of time before nature catches it. So it's wiser to go and have fair exchange and sustain it and build it and keep doing it. Your brand, your integrity, everything are to your favor by doing it. I think that's the difference. And I'm going to make a confront here. In Wall Street, it's happening right now in Wall Street. Right now in the Wall Street Journal, I saw it the other day, and also in USA Today. Goldman Sachs, for instance, the brokerage firms in Wall Street were basically feeding on ignorant people. They were basically taking advantage and charging management fees, high fees, trading fees, and doing dynamic tactical transactions where they were going back and forth and trading high numbers and making a fee on all the transactions. And the net return wasn't even beating the benchmark and the indices out there in the marketplace. Well, people finally caught on, and Goldman Sachs literally has dropped they were 30 times the amount of income they were making 10 years ago. They've dropped to 1/30th the amount because people figured it out, and now they're going over to index funds, which is what I've been teaching for almost 30 years, to save their money and save their cost and educate themselves. In the process of doing that, Goldman Sachs is now having to pay for all the narcissisms and taking advantage and exploiting the ignorant people, and now they're having to wake up and realize they've got to be back into fair exchange. So it's just a matter of time before fair exchange is the thing that makes sustainability.
Thank you, Dr. DiMartino. Another essential and must-do action is the ability to manage your emotions. Why is it so important when it comes to building wealth that you manage your emotions?
Okay, that's a very important one. Let's say that you have $1 million. Your net worth is $1 million. And you have it in various vehicles of investment, different classes of investment. And let's say the market races the year you have them, that money in it, and it goes to 1.3, it jumps up 30%, which is exactly what's going on in the market right now. Since Donald Trump got into office, elected in November, I believe November 8th in 2016, in that year that he was, from that year till now, the market has gone up 30%. So that means that if you had $1 million in the last year and 3 months or so, you've gone up 30%. Now, when you do, it's very easy to be vulnerable to mania, to become extroverted, to think that you're brilliant, to think you know what you're doing with investing. And you think, oh, my God, I'm an investor. And you tend to be extroverted and ask people how their investments are doing. And you tend to think, well, my God, I could go and borrow money at 5%, 6%, 4%, and I can go and get double-digit returns. I'm a genius. I'm going to borrow money on a margin account and leverage it, and I'm going to go and make money off that. The problem is that the market itself is above the average mean. And so right now, people are just emotionally sentiment, and they're basically with this irrational exuberance. And so the market's in kind of a bubble. So you're not really buying quality, intrinsic value of a company. You're buying smoke. You're buying people's mania. And so then when all of a sudden the market dips, which it's going to do soon, when it crashes, then what's going to happen is all of a sudden you now got to have a margin account. You're going to be in debt, and you're going to realize you paid too much for stock. And then you were ignorant because you got manic and you got proud and you got elated. And that's why emotions can undermine wealth on that end. But let's say that you find out the market crashes and it does an adjustment, like in 2000 when it adjusted in the tech sector, NASDAQ dropped 78%, literally in a matter of a week or so, 78%. That's a massive drop. So now if you had $1 million, imagine if it dropped to 200,000. Whoa, you'd be trying to sell out quick. You wouldn't probably have the skills to know how to short the market. You'd sell out quick. And man, you'd be depressed. You want to sell out quick because now you're frightened and you're depressed. And so you do foolish things with your money. When in actuality, when the market's crashing, that's the time to buy. And when the market is up above a really high percentage, might be wise to sell, or at least just sustain it. That's why you need liquid capital and a cushion to make sure you buffer and mitigate the volatilities of your emotions, because emotions destroy wealth because they get manic and they do foolish things using other people's money because you're narcissistic, or the other, you're altruistic when you're frightened and minimizing yourself and feel ashamed, you give it to other people, you sell out. So pride and shame, greed and fear, the two basic emotions, if they're taken to extreme, almost guaranteed to undermine wealth building and cause you to activate your amygdala, which is the animal brain. And animals usually don't become wealthy. Humans do. You need to stay in your executive center. You need to have a strategy. You need to follow the strategy. You need to have a liquid cushion to make sure that the emotions are mitigated, and you have capital. So if the market goes down, great, time to buy. That's why Buffett and these guys that have a lot of money keep a lot of cash on reserve. They wait for obvious crashes for the cash for the crash. And then they take advantage of incredible deals. And then they make money without having to do much thinking. So it's emotions that undermine wealth. And it's immediate gratification and gambling speculations that usually get you in trouble. And but it's a long-term visionary that usually gets ahead. And I'm the turtle, not the tortoise. The tortoise, not the hare, as they said. And I watch a lot of people that are going all over the place doing and trying to get the quickest get-rich scheme, which is the amygdala, which is the gambling casino. When you're looking at investments and somebody's advertising fancy cars, fancy boats, yachts, gold, diamonds, and everything else and the lifestyle, you know that they're not here to teach you about wealth building. They're here to capitalize on your emotions and sell you a fantasy. They're going to be wealthy, but you're not. But the people that are teaching you education about how money works, what psychology is involved there, and what actually goes on in the market, they're the people that are going to help you get along financially. So make sure you think about who you're actually interacting with and what you're learning. It's easy to get swayed by instant gratification and immediate gratifying, instant overnight wealth things. It's all over the news right now, in the media right now, Bitcoins and things like that. There's all kinds of things, like overnight millions. Well, if it doesn't have intrinsic value, it may not be there tomorrow. Make sure you're buying true assets that truly serve people long term. That's how you build long term wealth.
Thank you, Dr. DeMartini. And leading to action number 7 was to study everything you can about wealth building, saving and investing. Can you share an example of what you've learned that's had an impact on savings and investing? And can you share some recommendations on what you believe is wise to read or study on the topic?
Well, when I first started studying at age 28, wealth building, I went to the gentleman who initiated the Institute, the Association of Financial Planning, International Association of Financial Planning in Houston. He actually created it for the nation. Bright guy, very knowledgeable man. And I said, what does it take to be a financial planner and to learn how to build wealth? He says this and this and this. I said, well, why don't I go through the curriculum? I'll do it on my own initiative, not to be a financial planner, just for my own sake. So we kind of started that journey. And then I started making a commitment to reading books. I think I've done about 400 books on just investing, and probably 1,000 books on something to do with money over the years, because I used to just read them left and right. And each time you learn something, but I found out that a lot of it would fade if I didn't use it. And a lot of stuff I was reading, it was just scattering me around, and I was confused, because everybody, there's a dialectic of opposites out there trying to tell you one thing and another thing. And so I figured out that it's wiser to develop a strategy. As you learn something, don't just read it, but start compiling a strategy. Get a mentor that is already much wealthier than you, that is similar in value structure to you, that you can follow along, and get foresight and not have to learn through hindsight and trial and error, but educate yourself. And what I did is I found out that whenever I was saving and putting money in a money market, I would study everything money markets. When I started buying bonds, when the interest rates were higher, I studied bonds. When I started doing blue chip stocks and indices, I started studying those. I kept educating myself on what I was actually applying and didn't scatter myself with knowledge. And I found that I never forgot that information because I was applying it, using it. Knowledge that's applied is retained. So you want to do that. You want to learn. You want to become literate. There's Investopedia, which is online, which is a great educational, simple educational system. But I would start and read. And I think that one of the things that's probably wise to do is get old Benjamin Graham's Intelligent Investor, which is basic, and start learning. I think reading the investments by Warren Buffett, that is his quarterly reports and annual reports, I think are worth studying. You learn about investing. But I would not, don't confuse the brokerage business and buying and selling stocks as a day trader investing. They're not the same. In fact, I went and lectured to a number of financial institutions, Merrill Lynch one time. I think I've done about 14 of them. And Merrill Lynch, I spoke to 200 brokers there, and I asked point blank, how many of you are financial independent? 2 out of 200 had financial independence. And then when I confronted them, it wasn't barely financial independence. They were living a very high lifestyle. They were kind of like the Wolf from Wall Street, not on steroids, but on depressants. And people were basically living beyond their means, and they didn't have it. And they were the ones managing your money. And they're buying and selling and making money off it. And I thought, this is nuts. This is a roulette game. And I thought, that's not real financial wisdom there. I want to know people that actually have a net worth, that's accumulated it, that's sustained it, that lives moderately, that's living and not living beyond their means, that is actually having their money grow, and they're having a cause and they're structuring it. I'm interested in knowing what they do, how they do that, and study that. And there are fewer in between. Like I said, if there's tons of stuff out there in the world on finances, but still less than 1% financial independence. In fact, I went and looked at the Decamillionaire list, and it's 0.213% of the world's population become decamillionaires. In America, it's 0.312%. In some countries, it's a little higher or lower, but it's very small percent. It's less than 1%. It's only the 2 millionaires that make it into the 1%. The five ones make it to about 8.8%. That means very few people become these. And then you get a very small percentage that get into 50 million, 100 million, and into the billion marks. Very small percentage. Now, there's lots of them that are doing it out there, and you hear about them, but you don't hear about all the people that are actually not doing it. So make sure that you're mentoring under somebody that's actually accumulated it. Make sure that you're actually getting sound reason and not gambling, because there's a lot of people that want to gamble your money. Even the financial advisor that I studied with told me, don't ever trust somebody with your money. If they have a higher value on money than you, they'll get your money. They'll figure out how to get your money. Opportunities surround you. Make sure you actually invest your money wisely. That's why in the Breakthrough Experience, I teach people how to manage their emotions and have their intuition strengthened so they can catch people that are basically trying to take advantage of them in that way. So it's wise to learn that art and make and self-governing and study the heck out of it. If you really have a value on something, you study it. When you meet somebody you really value, you want to get to know them. If you really, truly want to build wealth, you will want to study it. You won't want to leave it. You want to study the statistics and probabilities and the math of it. And if that turns you off, oh, I don't want to know all that stuff, I'll just hand it to somebody else. You may get the right person, but you may find out that they actually have more love of your money than you do, and they may want to get your money. So beware, study it, value it, and appreciate what money is, because it is a universal medium to allow you to do and empower many areas of your life. And it's a reflection of what service you provided the world, and you deserve to be rewarded if you serve vastly.
Thank you, John. You mentioned that converting debt into a service is an important action. Can you elaborate on that a little bit further? As I'm sure a lot of people sit with that first hurdle to overcome.
Yes, if you have debt in any form, educational debt, mortgage debt, car debt, loan debt, any form of debts, don't be resentful to them. Be grateful for them. You may have done some maybe unwise actions and got yourself and bought. Whenever you borrow money, if you borrow money for things that go down in value, you're burdening yourself with debt. If you buy things that go up in value, then that may have a value. If you're buying a business with debt, that could be a value. It may produce more than the cost of the debt. But you don't want to, if you're really interested in building wealth, you don't want to spend money on debt for something that doesn't go up more than the cost of the debt and earn it more to pay for the debt. But if you're having debt, my advice is to write down the benefits you've received of it. Don't stop until you have a tear of gratitude for it. Because it's easier to pay debt when you have your debt that you're grateful for. It's hard to pay debt for something you resent. They discovered this when they were dealing with divorces and men and women had alimony and child support. They found out when they appreciated the person and had any degree of appreciation, they had a higher probability of paying off those alimonies and child supports. But if they had a real major resentment, they were very slow on paying and didn't want to pay, and they couldn't come up with it. And they come up with excuses why they couldn't pay. They even hindered their own growth of wealth, so they didn't have to pay it. I've seen it many, many times. So you want to write down the benefits of what you actually have received from the loan that you got or the debts that you have, so you're not resenting it. That's number one, because if you're grateful for it, it'd be easier to raise the money to pay it off. Number two, you want to take the total debt and calculate the total debt. Find out how much you're paying with the interest that you're paying on it, how much you're paying per year, how much you're paying per month, how much you're paying per week, how much you're paying per day, how much you're paying per hour. Chunking it down. Let's say you have $240,000 that you owe, and you have to pay $24,000 a year on it, and that's $2,000 a month, and it's $500 a week, and it's $100 a day, and it's basically, if you work 7 hours, it's $15 an hour. When you think of $15 an hour, psychologically, it has a different feeling than $250,000 almost in debt. So you always want to be grateful for the debt, chunk it down to small bites. Once it's down into small bites, you want to convert it into units of service. So let's say you're a doctor, and let's say you have an office of $60, and let's say you have an overhead cost of business of 50%. So you actually net $30 every time you do an office visit. And your debt is per hour, $15 per hour. That means you only need one half of a patient per hour to pay off your debt. And that means if you work 8 hours, that means you need 4 patients a day to pay off your debt. And if you convert it into units of service, instead of focusing on the debt, once you convert debt into units of service and focus on serving people, your debt goes down. But if you forget the people that you're serving and you're focusing on the debt, your service goes down. It's where you put your attention. You want to service the debt by converting debts into units of service and focusing on serving people because you love making a difference in people's lives. You love the feeling of serving and saying, hearing people say thank you. You love having fair exchange transactions. Focus on it and convert it into that and structure the debt where it's automated electronically, where you can't even mess it up. There's no emotion on it. You know, when you have emotions and you have to pay bills with emotions, you distract yourself. But if you just do it electronically and it's just automated and it's committed and now focused on serving people, you're servicing the debt that way. You'll focus on growing your business. And after a while, the debt will seem like a small thing. It wasn't even much. And all of a sudden, you paid off your debt. Along the way, as you're paying your debt off, it's wise never to stop your savings. Some bean counters, accountants will tell you, oh, pay off your debt, then you can save. I disagree. I think it's wise to save right from the beginning and pay off your debt and accelerate both. But never stop your savings. It's a habit. Because most people that never develop the habit of saving and they just keep paying off debt, the second they get out of debt, they or somebody in their family will want to go buy a new car, add on to the house, do furniture or do something and get further into debt again because their life is about debt. You got to realize that the average American and really around the world is pretty close, has 10% of their gross income on average on credit card debt per year. And the banks love with their fraction reserves and their overlending and everything else, they've loved giving you privileged credit cards so you can get further in debt so they can make the most money. But you need to make sure that you're paying off your debt, but at the same time, you don't want to rob your savings. My advice, if you can't pay off your debt every single month and keep it current, throw away your credit card, get rid of that, get something like an American Express that's accountable or an audited thing that is counted, you have to pay every month. If you don't make yourself accountable with your own value system, you need somebody to make you accountable, and don't accumulate the debt unless your debt is making you more money than the cost of the debt and you're making a profit on it. There's no harm in going out and getting in debt to create a business that's going to pay it off and make you profit. That's wise. That's leverage. But to go out and buy something that goes down in value that you have to pay off, that's now burden. And that's raising lifestyle, which is decreasing the probability of building financial independence. So you want to earn the right to risk that way. And you want to make sure that you convert your debts into services and focusing on serving. So if all of a sudden you're saving and you're only earning 5% on your savings debt, don't just pay off your debt and stop your savings. Put maybe 10% in your 90% in your debt, but never saving. That going. Then when you start to reduce debts, psychology is not as interesting. Wealth go up psychologically. So as your debt goes down, increase your savings. Don't wait. Because if you have a stall between the time your debt's gone and your savings are gone, your business will drop or you'll have an unexpected bill come in to do it. Because if you don't bring negentropy and order to your finances, entropy and unexpected bills take it away. That's why the wealthy always pay. They paid their savings and their mortal savings that they never touched. They paid their taxes. They paid their lifestyle, all budgeted, all electronically structured. And then they paid their business bills by priority. And they set up an investment account. They set up a vacation, an education, and a depreciation account and bills. They structured it. There's order to it. And therefore, more money comes to it. And you want to make sure you're doing that. The same with when it comes to investing in education. You want to set a separate account for education, a separate account for vacations, a separate account for investments that you never rob, so it grows forever, and also your depreciation account, the cost of business. If you structure it and you manage it wisely, you get more money to manage.
Thank you, DeMartini. We've got the final 9th must-do action, which is you briefly mentioned earlier, was to surround yourself with people that are more financially empowered than you and to find financially empowered mentors to guide you. Can you elaborate and advise how they can play a role in helping us to build wealth and financial freedom?
Well, unquestionably, if you hang out with people that have a lower value on money and have a lower net worth, if you're here and they're here, they're going to say you're expensive and you're greedy. That's what they're going to label you when you actually try to go into a transaction. They're going to try to bring you down to their level of thinking. If you get around people that have a higher net worth, a higher socioeconomic, and a higher value on wealth building, they're going to see you as, they're going to think of you as cheap and too generous. Almost most people will have recollections in their minds of memories where somebody looked at them and said, man, you ought to charge more for that. That's worth more than that. Yet other people saying, can you give me a deal? And that's based on where wealth building is in their value system. But if you sit there and buy into the person down, you'll go down with them. It's wiser to go and keep them, build them up, and help them go forward. Because I've never met anybody that gets up in the morning and says, I want less wealth, less income. I don't know of anybody that does that. They want to grow their wealth. They want to grow their potential. They want money working for them. They don't want to be a slave for money. They want to be a master of it. And you're not going to master it. So if you hang out with people that are higher in net worth, that are higher understanding, but also have meaning. And I'm going to go off on this tangent. People that make money that don't have meaning, that don't have fulfillment doing it, more likely to go into the amygdala and blow it on the Wolf of Wall Street mentality. But the people that have something, they grow wealth and they have meaning, they do something they love. I think of people like Herbert Wertheim, a very wealthy man. He's done amazing things. He's got 4,000 patents. He's opened up 4 universities. Amazing guy. Lives on our ship. He's an amazing guy. People like Elon Musk and people like Bill Gates and them, they have some purpose in their life. And they're building wealth not for the sake of just to go party. They're doing it because they want to make a difference in the world. That's why the cause is so important, to keep the executive center over the amygdala when it deals with managing money. So you want to make sure that you actually are hanging out with people that have greater wealth potential, wealth vision than you, managing when you, because they're going to encourage you to go up. Because everybody in their value system projects their values onto you, and the people that have a low value money said, why do you need to do that? You don't need all that money. You're so greedy. Why don't you give me a deal? And the people that have a higher value and says, you can do it. Stretch yourself. Go out and serve more people. You hang out with people that are wealthier, you end up wealthier. You hang out, the number of people that you typically hang out with will probably tell you your net worth. You hang out with billionaires, you end up a billionaire. You hang out with millionaires, you end up a millionaire. And if you save an increasing amount, the people you hang out with will change along the way. So that's the best advice I can say is, now it doesn't mean you can't hang out with the other people, but when you're doing, serve them, elevate them up, serve, be a service to them. But if you want mentorship, hang out with people that are a greater in potential and they'll stretch you. It's just stretching that makes you grow. It's not the shrinking.
And that brings us to the end of this episode of the Dr. Demartini Show. To determine and discover your values, head over to drdemartini.com, where you will also find blogs, videos, research materials, online courses, and exactly how you can sign up to become part of the breakthrough experience in your local city. We look forward to sharing more inspired insights.